question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, January 19th, 2012, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
Obama rejects the Keystone Tar Sands pipeline and a major victory for environmentalists. A new report on corporations that pay more to lobby than in taxes. Plus a look at youth homicide in California and why it remains a serious problem. And a commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. President Barack Obama announced yesterday that his administration is rejecting the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline planned from Alberta, Canada to the U.S. Gulf Coast. Activists are declaring a cautious victory over the rejection of the 1,700-mile pipeline project, which attracted some of the largest protests in the history of the environmental movement last year. Mass public opposition to the pipeline is based on the fact that it would have cut across the United States, particularly under the nation's largest aquifer, with the likelihood of numerous and disastrous future leaks all but guaranteed. The tar sands pipeline was also projected to significantly accelerate the emission of greenhouse gas-driven climate change. The Obama administration's rejection is based on the fact that no alternate pipeline route was proposed and that the environmental impact was not properly assessed in justifying the State Department's rejection of the final permit. The president said in a statement, quote, "The rushed and arbitrary deadline insisted on by congressional Republicans prevented a full assessment of the pipeline's impact, especially the health and safety of the American people, as well as our environment." However, the State Department also issued a statement leaving open the door for future motion on the pipeline, saying, quote, "The denial of the permit application does not preclude any subsequent permit application or applications for similar projects." Meanwhile, Lieutenant Dan Choi, one of many people arrested in protest of the tar sands pipeline last August, will go to trial on Monday, January 24th. He is one of only three people of all those arrested who is facing trial. Dan Choi is perhaps best known for his public opposition to the now defunct Don't Ask, Don't Tell military policy under which he was discharged and has been outspoken on a number of progressive issues. He now joins me on the phone. Welcome to Uprising.
Great to be with you in the Uprising.
Also with
in the
us.
Revolution.
There you go. Also with us is Kim Nguyen. She is the federal dirty fuels campaigner with Friends of the Earth, and she returns to Uprising to discuss the status of this pipeline project. Welcome back, Kim.
Thanks for having me back on.
Well, Kim, I'd like to start with you because the news, of course, of this rejection is a pretty big deal for environmentalists, for activists like yourself and Dan. How significant is this? Can the Keystone XL pipeline be declared dead?
Absolutely. Well, I will start up by saying that the Keystone XL fight is one of those iconic David versus Goliath fights. And I think what we saw yesterday was the climate movement really taking on Goliath and winning and demonstrating its truly growing strength. And this iconic victory really bears witness to the power of committed grassroots activism to bring about real and critically needed change. I will say that, you know, we think that the president did show bold leadership and we applaud him for the decision. It was the right decision to make, but there are certainly things that President Obama did not do. And in his statement, the White House did not, you know, very clearly close the door to the pipeline once and for all. Actually, it left the door open to the southern segment of Keystone XL, which would allow the oil to be exported overseas. Which is really the reason that TransCanada has pushed for this pipeline to be built. And, you know, I think we're a little bit disappointed that the president did not, in fact, mention at all climate change or what this project would contribute to expedite disastrous global warming.
Well, Dan Choi, upon hearing what happened yesterday, do you feel vindicated in your protest of this pipeline?
I think a lot of us do. I think what Kim is saying is absolutely right. This is an iconic moment for the movement, really the movement, but the science of climate change. And we need to, as citizens, realize that it is for those who sacrifice, for those who put themselves on the line. It is a victory not only for us, but for all of society that we were standing up for, that we were standing up against these small numbers of very rich, very powerful elites, very powerful oil corporations, lobbies, and all of that. We stood up against those small numbers of people, and we gave voice to a larger revolution that was going on. I wouldn't say revolution, actually. It's an evolution of people to recognize that they, too, can take part. So that's really what we're seeing on a social movement scale, on a societal scale, is that the possibility, the potentiality that some people could wake up and say, I can do it, too. It really does harken back to the iconic sayings of and chants of President Obama's campaign, yes, we can, or Che Guevara, si se puede. Like, why do we say those things? Because the missing ingredient in most of our lobbying, and I know Kim's part of the great lobbying and great public service and organization, but what is generally missing in most progressive movements is not the science and the academia and the knowledge, but it's the ability to say, yes, we can also affect change.
Kim, let's talk about the response today to the rejection of the permit. One can only imagine what the response would have been in the media if Obama had approved the permit. We wouldn't be seeing media coverage or op-eds that discuss the political price he would now be paying for approving. Instead, of course, we're upon his rejection of the permit, we're seeing a lot of articles and reports about the impact of his rejection on his presidency, because, of course, the sort of corporate price he'll pay may be heavier. John Boehner, House Speaker, made a statement immediately following the announcement by the president of rejecting the pipeline deal. And of course, the main issue being raised was jobs. I want to play for you and Dan and our listeners what John Boehner specifically had to say.
The president has said he'll do anything that he can to create jobs. Today, that promise was broken. The president expedited the approval of the Solyndra loan project, but won't approve a project that's been under review for over 3 years. Yesterday, the president's own jobs council said the energy pipeline projects like this one can create hundreds of thousands of American jobs. The unions support it, the states along the proposed route support it, and it has bipartisan support here in the Congress of the United States. And yet, the president decided to reject it anyway. The president won't stand up to his political base, even in the name of creating American jobs.
Kim, when American jobs are being raised as the major loser in this rejection, and as the Speaker of the House said, some unions were very much in favor of this pipeline project. I want to get your response to this claim that there would have been a lot of jobs created, but then also very interesting thing that Boehner said near the end there, that the president wouldn't stand up to his political base. It seems as though that's all he has been doing, aside from a few moments like this. Kim?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think we can definitely agree on the notion that the Keystone XL pipeline has been a political football that's been tossed around in the halls of Congress through the last months of the last year. and also for the administration, it's been a political football. You know, I think we don't think that the president made this decision to help his reelection campaign. I think that he made this decision because, again, of the immense grassroots pressure that was put to bear on him by the immense amount of work that has gone, that has been put into building this coalition, building this movement over the last 2 years. I will say, in response to the jobs issue, that a number of the country's biggest unions came out yesterday signing on in support of the president's decision, namely SEIU, United Steelworkers Union, the Transport Workers Union, United Auto Workers. And in their statement, they actually pointed to the fallacy that the Republican talking points essentially have been saying that this announcement is a jobs killer, when in fact they have been working all of this time to kill jobs themselves through rejecting a lot of the initiatives that have been proposed by the administration, namely voting against, you know, extending unemployment insurance benefits and blocking any consideration of the Restore the American Dream Act, which would create and save 2.3 million jobs in 2012. And so, you know, again, we think it is extremely political, and that's what shaped and made this debate so interesting and controversial and frustrating at times. But in the end, we think that, you know, President Obama made this decision because of the immense pressure that was brought to bear on him.
Dan Choi, Kim Nguyen said that she doesn't think that Obama did this because of re-election, but responding to grassroots pressure. What do you think, and does it matter why he did it?
Well, on this point, I think Kim is dead wrong. I think the issue here, you can't say that we responded to grassroots pressure and then say it's not something dealing with a political campaign or re-election issue. Of course it is. Number one, the only reason why the grassroots pressure was applied correctly was because it dealt in 2012 a devastating blow to Obama's volunteer base. I think, Kim, for you to ignore that really repudiates the leadership of Bill McKibben and what he said. One year until the election, until the political election, we are surrounding the White House. You know, to just say that that didn't exist, I think, is an insult to the movement. Of course it was political. Mm-hmm. For you to sit there and say, no, it wasn't the political calculation, President Obama is just like any other political campaigner. And I think, you know, number one, we as the political base need to stop tailoring our message on the radio or on free speech forums. Then stop saying, oh, you know, no, you Republicans are wrong about us. You know, we do that all the time, Kim, and respectfully, I think what you do right here to say, no, it's not political, I take great insult to that.
Okay, well, let me give Kim a chance to respond to that, Kim Nguyen.
Sure. Well, I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I'm saying. This was a very, very political issue, and I think that's what actually created the power. You know, 6 months ago, Friends of the Earth has been, first of all, I will say that Friends of the Earth has been working to stop this pipeline for the last 2 years. And up until 6 months ago, it was barely acknowledged.
And Kim, you were in D.C. yourself protesting, weren't you?
That's correct. I mean, we work very closely with Bill with 350, and consider them very close allies. So again, I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I'm saying in that, that this wasn't a political, issue at all, because it absolutely was. And that is actually, I think, something that was very successful on the part of the coalition of groups that worked on this, to make it a national issue, to make it a political issue, to make the president feel this political pain, that this would be political pain for him if he chose the wrong way on this decision. It absolutely was of utmost importance. And so, I don't want anyone to misunderstand what I'm saying here.
The reason why I bring this up is because, like you said, it is not done yet. This issue is still a live ticking time bomb because President Obama did not address the merits of climate change. He did not appeal to the base to the point of saying, yes, this winter that's going on right now, why would we have people in Bermuda shorts walking around outside? This is climate change, and it's going to be worse in the summer. You know, I'm disappointed that President Obama does not serve as a voice really for that base, and I think that's where we agree. I mean, the issue of jobs here, Kim, you and I, we agree on this, and maybe you're representing your organization, but, you know, as far as what I represent, I think that whole jobs meme out there was phony. The only thing that this rejection rejected was the con job and the hit job of the pipeline. That was the only one job that was going to come out of this whole thing, and clearly it had nothing to do with thousands of people having work. If anything, we should put people to work with new kinds of energy, solar and wind, and all sorts of new technology.
Right. Well,
we're creative people, we need to do more. We can. Mm-hmm. Anything that we can, and that's why I'm occupying the courts.
I don't want to ask you about that, Dan, and as well as your case in just a moment. But I want to turn back to Kim Nguyen to pick up on this issue that Dan brought up, which is that this may not be dead yet. This is such a huge project that it's very likely TransCanada will reapply for the permit, and after the election is over, the whole story may be quite different. What do you think will happen?
Absolutely. Well, we certainly expect that TransCanada will reapply. That they are working on their application as we speak. We also, in President Obama's statement yesterday, he, as I mentioned, did leave the door open for the southern segment of the pipeline, which would connect tar sands deposits to international markets, international ports on the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly, I can't peer into the crystal ball and tell what's going to happen, but we certainly, Friends of the Earth, along with our allies and the immense grassroots movement that has built up around this issue in the last two years, will certainly be there to meet them when they do that.
Well, Kim Nguyen, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Give out a website for Friends of the Earth.
Absolutely. It's www.foe.org.
That's foe.org. Kim Nguyen is the federal dirty fuels campaigner with Friends of the Earth. Still with us is Lieutenant Dan Choi, Iraq war veteran. He was discharged from the army under the now defunct Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He's one of several people who was arrested last August during protests against the Keystone XL pipeline in D.C. Dan Choi, you're participating in the Occupy the Courts movement in D.C. And you yourself, your trial will begin on Monday. Can you tell us briefly what you expect? I understand you're pleading not guilty. And what exactly are you being accused of?
They say that I was failing to obey a traffic cop, the failure to obey an order. They're also saying that I blocked traffic. The only thing that we were obstructing was the dirty oil that was coming out here. And I'm proud to have obstructed that. What we suspect will happen is prosecutors going to come in and say that they have a strong case, and you know, as we were essentially doing a sit-in at the White House, we see people from all over the country doing all sorts of wonderful, creative, nonviolent direct action, which is what we were all talking about here when Kim was with us here. I think that is a fundamental interest of the citizens, not only an interest, but a responsibility. So I plead not guilty, number one, because I'm not guilty. I have no shame or guilt or remorse, and I'll do it again. There's again and again and again, and that's what we have to show people. And that's why when we say, I demand a trial, I want you to prove your accusations, you do not get to overreach. You as a government do not get to just say whatever, who is a criminal, who is a terrorist, who is that. We need to challenge all of this. And so when I plead not guilty, it's not just for me. It's for you. It's for everybody to know that they can also do this, that the court system is our court system. And if it's not working, it's our fault. Let's go in there and let's make sure that they know. Let's put them all on notice. I think we need to challenge this stuff in every single aspect of our government.
Well, Dan Choi, would you like to give out a website where listeners can find out more about your work?
Well, I would much rather direct them to 350.org and Friends of the Earth and all these other groups that are doing great work. Mine, of course, I do tweet at LT Dan Choi. I'll keep people up to date, of course. I'd love to hear everybody else who stands up and joins the uprising.
Thank you so much, Dan Choi. Best of luck to you in your trial. You can follow Lieutenant Dan Choi on Twitter at LTDanChoi, C-H-O-I. And he also recommends 350.org. Friends of the Earth's website is FOE.org. This is Uprising. We've just been discussing the Obama administration's rejection of the Keystone XL pipeline. And later in the hour, we'll take a look at youth violence in California. We'll also hear commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal. And after this short break, a new report called The Dirty 30, corporations that spend more on lobbying than on paying taxes. Stay tuned.
The power of the drum and the healing force of women's voices live on stage. Celebrating the groundbreaking exhibition, Women Hold Up Half the Sky, the Skirball Cultural Center presents LA's beloved all-woman percussion ensemble, Adawe, Friday, January 20th. With high-octane energy, Adawe fuses the ancient rhythms of Ghana and West Africa with R&B pop vocals, gospel harmonies, and uplifting lyrics that celebrate love, empowerment, and peace. Adawe at the Skirball, Friday, January 20th. For more information, call 310-440-4500 or visit kpfk.org. KPFK is a proud media sponsor for Adawe at the Skirball.
Put it to the sky, I'm blazing. Steel chasing, steel wasting, deal makers. Steer fakers, whipped and stripped, dear naked. Praying to the dear sacred for their patience. I cross forks and roads, got crossed for show. Got lost and got caught off on my toes. Got once, but never since or before. Ever since I've been told I'm the wrong man to throw. Bones with cold since December left me broken. Like the window in my room forever open. Next to roaches, crawling with my road smoking. Toast y'all who grow false to scenes, blows with noses.
Devil on Skates by Blue, based here in Los Angeles. Find out more at myspace.com/herfavecolor, H-E-R-F-A-V-C-O-L-O-R. That's where you can find the streaming music, or also just check the featured music section on uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Led by General Electric CEO Jeffrey Immelt, President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness released a report yesterday suggesting major changes to the U.S. corporate tax code, which they say would stimulate the economy and create jobs. The 27-member body recommends widening the corporate tax base and decreasing rates. It also suggests that the U.S. change to a territorial corporate tax system, which would exempt most taxes on foreign income brought into the U.S. Those council members in support of this argued that currently, to avoid taxation, U.S. corporations invest less of their foreign income in the U.S. than they would like to. Accounting Today reports that not all members agree that this shift will result in an economic stimulus and want safeguards against more tax loopholes. It is not likely, though, that a body led by a General Electric CEO will make significant strides in increasing the corporate tax rate. In the 3 years before Jeffrey Immelt joined the President's Council on Jobs in 2011, GE made over $10 billion in profit, spent $79 million on lobbying, and paid $0 in taxes. GE's tax exploits have landed it on the 2008 to 2010 Dirty 30 list of corporations that spent more money on lobbying than taxes over the 3-year period. U.S. PERG and Citizens for Tax Justice compiled the list as part of their joint report, Representation Without Taxation, Fortune 500 companies that spend big on lobbying and avoid taxes. GE is not the only household name that made it onto the Dirty 30 list. Verizon Communications secured a spot for receiving tax rebates from the government while spending $52 million on lobbying over 3 years. Wells Fargo also rang in a negative tax rate and spent $11 million to influence Congress. PG&E, the energy giant responsible for a natural gas pipeline explosion in Northern California that killed 8 people, is also on the list. From 2008 to 2010, PG&E spent $70 million to lobby Congress, raked in over $4 billion in profit, and paid $0 in taxes. My guest is Blair Bowie. She is the democracy advocate at US PIRG. Welcome to Uprising.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, certainly it's not a new thing that there are plenty of corporations that effectively pay $0 in taxes. How is your report different from other lists of corporations that don't pay much in taxes? You specifically compared taxes to how much is spent on lobbying?
Yeah, so we decided to look at tax rates and lobbying as a cross-section of one area of legislation where corporate power and influence is on full display. The tax code is just riddled with special tax provisions and loopholes that have been won through decades of corporate lobbying. And to me, the fact that 29 corporations can pay less than nothing in taxes while spending almost $500 million on lobbying makes a mockery of both our tax code and our democracy.
Well, the loopholes that these companies use to essentially not pay any taxes, how do you correlate those? I mean, are they directly correlated to how much they spend on lobbying?
Well, you can't make that sort of direct comparison. One thing that we did look at was the actual returns that these corporations got if you compare the lobbying to the tax breaks that they received. And we found in that for every dollar that these corporations spend lobbying, they get $220 back in tax rebates. Now, the system of influence in Washington is a little bit more complicated than that, but this is just one way to look at the issue of corporate power and influence in legislation.
So let's talk about some of these companies. I mentioned General Electric and Verizon and PG&E, et cetera. Who do they spend most of their money on? Are we talking directly into the campaign coffers of members of Congress, both in the House and the Senate? Are there particular correlations you can make or patterns that you can find with one party or another?
Well, it's hard to say because actually campaign contributions and lobbying kind of go across the board and across partisan lines for most of these corporations. To them, it's mostly important that they have the ear of every legislator. And actually, the reason that we put out this report this week was to highlight lobbying and its apparent effect on tax policy close to the second anniversary of the Citizens United decision,
right,
which 2 years ago, the Supreme Court declared that corporations can spend unlimited amounts of money on campaign contributions.
So does this three-year period that your report covers, does that include, it includes certainly some post-Citizens United lobbying, but the real deluge is probably starting this year?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And most of the findings presented in our report largely take place before the Supreme Court's decision, but they indicate the kind of corporate influence that will continue to grow even greater in the absence of reforms or overturning the Supreme Court's decision.
So how is it that you have these corporations then that have representatives on the President's Jobs Council? I mean, the GE CEO, Jeffrey Immelt, is leading President Obama's Council on Jobs and Competitiveness, and they are very high up in your list of Dirty 30. So clearly their goal is going to be to increase and maximize profit, not necessarily to create jobs. So, how much influence, is this also the kind of thing that you are seeing, that the influence that these companies buy in the government lands them such high power positions such as this?
Yeah, and that would be an example of the revolving door that goes on between some of these corporations, these lobbying groups, and the government, which just increases the access that corporations have and their influence and ability to change legislation and to morph even the activity of the executive branch to gain more profits.
If these companies had been paying the tax rate that corporations are supposed to pay, 35% tax rate, how much money would federal treasury coffers be seeing? How much more money would there be for the president to and Congress to allocate for social services?
Well, if you look at the full 280 companies that we surveyed, if they had paid the statutory 35% tax rate on their profits, they would have paid an extra $223 billion just during this particular three-year period.
$223 billion in taxes.
That's right. Yeah, and when corporations are able to skirt those taxes, of course, it's the ordinary American taxpayers and the small businesses that have to pick up the tab. And we looked at, if you spread out just the taxes that were avoided by the Dirty 30, which is those corporations that spent more money lobbying than they paid in taxes, that actually amounts to an average of $481 per taxpayer that we had to pick up the tab for.
Now, the President's Job Council also brought up the issue of allowing corporations to bring in money that they earn outside the United States without having to pay too many taxes on it. And they're saying that this basically leads to the fact that taxes have to be paid on foreign income, leads to fewer jobs being created. How do you respond to that?
Well, That idea has actually been done before. That's a repatriation of these taxes that the profits that these corporations have stashed overseas using tax haven schemes. And it just seems ridiculous that it's sort of like rewarding a child for taking candy out of a candy store. You know, they've hidden their profits overseas, so allowing them to bring them back to the U.S. without paying the fair tax rate, it's just not fair.
And how many of the Dirty 30 corporations engage in offshore tax havens, use offshore tax havens to hide their profits?
Well, we found that at least 22 of the corporations of the 30 use offshore tax havens.
That you know of?
Yeah, that we know of, right. That's actually an incomplete picture because the reporting requirements on tax havens are very subpar.
I'm speaking with Blair Bowie, democracy advocate at USPIRG, Federation of State Public Interest Research Groups, incidentally, and we're discussing the Dirty 30 report, which is Representation Without Taxation is the name of the report. Fortune 500 companies that spend big on lobbying and avoid taxes. It seems as though this report is exactly the sort of fodder that social movements that are represented by, for example, the Occupy movement need to make their case about the stranglehold that corporations have on public policy, on government policy.
Yeah, I think that that's entirely right. And one of the reasons that we chose the title, Representation Without Taxation, is to highlight that there is a growing sense in our country that our government is not hearing the voices of ordinary citizens, and the fact that these corporations that are not even giving back to society in the most basic way of paying their taxes have so much say and so much influence is really enraging. And I think it would be great if groups that are feeling that way seize on this report and use it to move the ball forward.
And in your report, do you see a trend in terms of how much money is spent on lobbying? Are we seeing a government that each year is flooded with more and more cash, or does it hold fairly steady?
Yes, certainly. I mean, the cost of lobbying has continually gone up. We've seen in the last 10 years, in 1998, the total lobbying expenditures that were spent was $1.44 billion. And now in 2010, and this was the last year that we have a complete picture for, $3.51 billion was the total amount spent on lobbying. So it's certainly a growing industry.
So what do you want to happen now? I mean, certainly there are major steps being taken by different movements around the country to overturn Citizens United, to even push for a constitutional amendment on that, to overturn the concept of corporate personhood, which would certainly impact the amount of money that corporations spend in government. Are those the kinds of things that U.S. PERG recommends based on this report?
Well, ultimately, you know, the nature of a Supreme Court decision is that they either will have to come to their senses or we will have to force them to come to their senses by passing a constitutional amendment. I love that there's a movement growing around that. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to pass one before the 2012 elections. So I'm looking at certain ways that we can limit corporate influence in this upcoming election. And I have two recommendations for that. The first and foremost is that we need full and honest disclosure around campaign financing. One of the biggest problems with Citizens United is that these new super PACs don't have sufficient reporting standards, so we don't know who's spending money to support which candidate.
And we will be looking at the power of the super PACs in this election as an ongoing part of our election coverage. We've already been covering it. And of course, the South Carolina primary for the GOP is coming up and super PAC money is flooding that. Is an interesting role being played by the by Comedy Central's Stephen Colbert, who has his own super PAC, to make a statement about the role of super PACs. Blair Bowie, where can listeners get more information about the report? Where can they download the report and see it for themselves? It's the kind of thing that might be, you know, to have hard numbers like this might be very useful in the hands of activists.
Yeah, absolutely. I encourage people to go online to USPIRG, that's USPIRG.org. You can download the report there under our tax and budget policy. And we do encourage people to use these statistics and get them out there.
Okay. Well, Blair Bowie, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And I will link to your website from our site, uprisingradio.org.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much. Blair Bowie is democracy advocate at US PERG. This is Uprising, and after this break, we'll take a look at a recent report on California youth violence. Stay tuned.
Mexico's official entry into the Oscar race for Best Foreign Language Film, Miss Bala, tells the story of Laura, a young woman whose aspirations of becoming a beauty queen turn against her, delivering her into the hands of a gang that's terrorizing northern Mexico. Learning that the price of a crown may not be worth becoming an unwilling participant in a violent drug war, she is shaken and transformed. On Variety's list of 10 directors to watch, Gerardo Naranjo has been heralded as a major talent after an impressive debut at Cannes. Miss Bala opens on Friday, January 20th at Landmarks Regent, 1045 Broxton Avenue in Westwood. A limited number of tickets have been offered to KPFK Film Club members who are invited to call the front desk during business hours at 818-985-2711 dial 0 for operator for a pair of tickets good Monday through Thursday. And if you aren't already a Film Club member, go to kpfk.org for further information on how to join.
This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. Mumia Abu-Jamal is a political prisoner, an award-winning journalist who was recently taken off death row and transferred to Pennsylvania in early December. He recently wrote this commentary called Toy Soldiers.
Toy Soldiers. For Mumia Abu-Jamal, I'm Ron Kovic, author of Born on the 4th of July. According to recent news accounts, shattered and shredded body parts and remains of U.S. servicemen were found in a landfill. Despite political spins, this sobering image is a telling true-life metaphor for what those in power really think of soldiers, many of whom are but boys and girls freshly loosed from high school. In recent years, politicians, especially when on TV or radio talk shows, are apt to say when addressing a vet, "I thank you for your service." In truth, this is robot talk, kind of like when a parrot is trained to say hello, and about as meaningful. The American poet E.E. Cummings once said, "A politician is an arse upon which everyone has sat except a man." John Africa said, "A politician will tell you he wasn't born of a woman if it'll get you to vote for him." In these passing years since 9/11, wars have been fought that have devastated countries, economies, and world peace. Untold thousands have died, many for nothing more nor less than American paranoia. Thousands of U.S. soldiers have died defending American lives, and tens of thousands have returned, bodies, minds, souls shattered by political calculations driven by arrogance, greed, and sheer stupidity. Thousands of marriages have ended in divorce because of forced years apart, and families have been broken asunder because some greasy politician wanted to play war president or senator or representative. In a real sense, military body parts tossed into landfills as trash is more than metaphor. It is truth. Prison and government officials are trying to censor and silence Mumia Abu-Jamal. I stand as one of many Americans who believe that there is tremendous value in his voice being heard. I and others will fight to make sure that both his voice and his body are free. This is Ron Kovic for Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You can find all of Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries online at prisonradio.org. This last commentary was read by war veteran Ron Kovic. Because Mumia Abu-Jamal has been returned to solitary confinement, does not have access to phones, he was transferred to SCI Mahanoy in Frackville, Pennsylvania in early December, where it was expected he would be released from solitary confinement and transferred into the general population and would finally have contact visits. However, he was immediately placed in what's called administrative custody. In the first week of January, at his request, supporters have begun a campaign directed at the Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections and the DA, Seth Williams, demanding that Abu-Jamal be immediately transferred to the general population. The National Lawyers Guild has released a statement and created an online petition demanding his transfer to a general population. That petition can be found online at freemumia.com. You can also find a link at uprisingradio.org later today. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. LA County officials, led by Sheriff Lee Baca, announced last week that crime rates in LA County fell more than 4% in 2011, with cities like Compton seeing a 40% reduction in homicides over the last few years. Sheriff Baca credited citywide initiatives like education-based prison programs and improved police networking for the decrease. According to a new report, however, Los Angeles County's youth homicide rate is still the 10th highest in the state when compared to other counties. This and other findings are detailed in the Violence Policy Center's report, Lost Youth, a County-by-County Analysis of 2010 California Homicide Victims Aged 10 to 24. The VPC study found that homicide continues to be the second leading cause of death for California's youth, although there was an overall decrease in the homicide rate. In 2009, the youth homicide rate was 10.48 youth per 100,000, but dropped to 8.48 per 100,000 in 2010. For the second year in a row, Monterey County led the state in youth homicide, with 24.36 homicides per 100,000 youth in 2010. The report also found that compared to white homicide rates, black youth homicide rates are 22 times higher, Hispanic homicide rate incidents are 5 times higher. For cases in which it could be documented, the report found that 50% of black and Hispanic youth killed were murdered by a stranger. The VPC found that young men are at far higher risk of homicide than their female counterparts. 89% of all young people killed in the state are male. The report concludes that firearms are the weapon of choice for most youth homicides and recommends, quote, effective violence-preventing strategies must include measures that prioritize preventing youth and young adults from accessing firearms, especially handguns. Joining me on the phone now is the Violence Policy Center's Executive Director, Josh Sugarman. Welcome to Uprising, Josh.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Billy P. Weiss, who is the MPH Department of Epidemiology at the UCLA School of Public Health. Welcome to Uprising, Billy.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Josh Sugarman, first, is it not an optimistic sign that overall homicide rates are decreasing? And if so, what does that say about how these rates have gone down?
It's a very optimistic sign. And what we found in our study was that of the top 10 counties, six of them, their rates had actually decreased in the prior year. This is the year that we've done the study. And what we found, which is very interesting to us, is looking at some of the news coverage of the study, a constant theme emerges in each of the counties, and that's there's a collaborative approach involving law enforcement, local policymakers, community organizations and members working together to decrease violence, especially among youth. And so taken together, yes, there was a lot of positive to be found in this study, but unfortunately it still remains a severe problem for youth in California.
How does California compare to other states, Billy?
I actually don't have those data right now. Mm-hmm. Josh may know that. California generally has been quite high, but in the last 10, 15 years, my impression is that California has settled back into the pack down at about 26 or 27. Josh, you may have...
Josh?
Well, if you look at California compared to other states overall, and if you look at for gun death as a total, these numbers are a little bit older, and I can pull them up as we're talking. Generally, California tends to be fairly low. And looking at gun death in California for the year 2008, the overall rate was 8.67 per 100,000, and that ranked them 38th in the country. But that's overall gun death, homicides, suicides, unintentional shootings. But what it does make clear is that we believe that the comprehensive nature of California's gun laws and the relatively low gunnership rates in California are having a real effect.
And Billy Weiss, let's talk about what are some of these very specific things that are done here in Los Angeles, in L.A. County, that have led to reductions in youth violence.
In Los Angeles, we have some unique programs going on. We have had a collaborative effort going on for the past 10 or 15 years in Los Angeles with community-based agencies working together, working with city and county programs as well as faith-based programming. In the past almost 6 years now, we've also had a gang intervention program run by the city, which is really based on a report that was done earlier in the decade, showing that gang violence really is the major cause of youth homicide rates in Los Angeles. So we have a program that employs mostly former gang members, and they work on the streets doing intervention on the streets. We also have a high-risk early intervention program dealing with young people who have family members or other high-risk factors for joining gangs.
And how do you respond, Billy, to Sheriff Baca's justification or crediting of city initiatives like education-based prison programs and improved police networking as a reason why we're seeing some decrease in the homicide rates?
I'm sure that some of the education-based programming going on in the jails has been helpful. Some of those programs are actually run by interventionists and community-based organizations in collaboration with law enforcement, which is making those programs much more relevant to young people as they're coming out of the prisons. The other thing that we've had a real push on and we're working very hard to get going in Los Angeles County right now is greater emphasis on reentering youth, those coming out of the juvenile justice system. So, and those are educational programs as well as specific service delivery for those young people who need them.
I want to turn back to Josh Sugarman, who is also the co-author of the report Lost Youth, along with being the executive director of the Violence Policy Center. What correlation or how do you conclude that firearms and access to firearms are one of the most important things to consider when we are looking at these homicide rates that are still quite high, even if there's an overall decrease?
Well, as you noted in your introduction, 87% of the victims in the 10 to 24 age range were killed by firearms. So far and away, the most prevalent weapon used, unfortunately, because of guns' unique lethality. Of that percentage, three-quarters were killed with handguns. Hmm. So coming from the data, and this is across the board, and we see it, you know, across the state of California, county by county, firearms are the number one means by which these homicides are being committed.
And how easy is it to access firearms, Josh?
Well, California has arguably the toughest gun laws in the country, the most comprehensive gun laws in the country. In the same way that the state is a leader on violence prevention, it's also a leader in firearm regulation. Having said that, California is not an island, and you have trafficking into the state from other regions of the country, other states with far more lax regulation of firearms. And on top of that, you still have, obviously, legal firearms that are being used in homicide, suicide, and unintentional injuries.
So you're saying that even if California were to have, you know, even though California has these tough laws, the fact that there are not strong enough or strict enough federal laws in place or strict enough laws in other states, it enables somebody to just drive in guns from Texas, Arizona, et cetera?
Correct. What's most striking is that if you look at overall gun death rate in this country, and this is year in and year out, the states with the toughest gun laws, primarily California and states on the East Coast, starting in Massachusetts and going down all the way to Maryland, have the lowest overall gun death rates. The states with the most lax gun laws, higher rates of gun ownership, have the highest rates of gun death. And what's striking is that when you look at them, it's the, for lack of a better phrase, the pro-gun states with the highest gun death rates that they say, you know, when you ask them about it, say, you know, we know guns, we respect guns. And they're literally shocked when you explain to them, well, you have the highest gun death rates, because it goes against all their beliefs regarding firearms and gun possession, gun ownership.
And it was last December during the holiday season, there was, I understand, the highest number of guns purchased in a holiday season than in many, many years. Let's talk. I want to go back to Billy Weiss and ask you about the way in which we see other policies affecting youth violence, particularly juvenile justice, the juvenile justice system here. California's prison system has been under a lot of scrutiny in recent years. How do the conditions within juvenile facilities, prison facilities, affect rates of violence among young people in California?
Well, they affect, for the most part, they have been affecting them negatively. Young people that are incarcerated often become involved in gang activity if they were not before they got in order for preservation inside these institutions. It's been very interesting to watch, for example, Massachusetts some years ago had a policy where they turned all their young people out of their institutions and put them on the streets with maximum supervision from probation officers, as well as and put them in touch with community-based agencies, and they participated in community programs. Their gang problem is very different than ours. Their gang members didn't have the chance to mesh together like ours have. We also have entrenched gang families here in Los Angeles, which makes it very difficult. So the real push in the last few years is to bring community-based agencies into the juvenile justice system as the young people are going in, so that they get ongoing support and learn alternatives to violence inside the institutions, with good program planning for when they come back out on the streets, and support services. That seems to have been very helpful. The problem has been that our juvenile justice systems have been so overcrowded and so understaffed and with so many systemic problems that it's been difficult to really sort out and get a good evaluation on how much impact that's the community-based programming inside the institutions has had.
Well, I want to finally ask both of you to give your recommendations for what you think will further reduce the numbers of homicide rates, not just in L.A. County, but statewide. Josh Sugarman, first. I'm assuming that you might be backing greater, stronger gun laws statewide, but also federally?
Well, of course, federal laws need to be tightened to protect states like California that have comprehensive gun laws and recognize link between firearms availability and higher rates of lethality. I think one thing that comes out of this study, which we plan to do next year and the year after, is that there needs to be a continued focus on local solutions involving communities, involving all aspects of a community, from local communities to counties. But I think also what comes out of it is a recognition that California is making tremendous progress, and California is really a leader in violence prevention. I think many other states could look to California to start addressing their own issues of youth violence in particular and gun violence in general.
And, Josh, where can listeners download the report that you've co-authored?
The report is located at the Violence Policy Center's website, which is www.vpc.org.
That's vpc.org. We'll link to that. Billy Weiss, your recommendations briefly.
Well, I would agree with Josh. And while we have been very successful in passing good gun, federal, local gun legislation and state legislation in California, we do need to work to assure that our state does not become so impacted by our surrounding states that we have more guns flooding into this state than we have now. I also think that while we have very good community-based programming and we have good collaboration right now, mm-hmm. all of this programming is in danger because of funding issues.
Right. And, of course, we continue to cover those sorts of issues. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I want to thank you very much, Billy Weiss, for joining us today. Billy Weiss is with the Department of Epidemiology at the UCLA School of Public Health. Josh Sugarman, Executive Director of the Violence Policy Center. For Sonali's subversive thought for the day, Chris Hedges once said, "Violence is a disease that corrupts all who use it, regardless of the cause." You've been listening to Uprising. Martina Steiner is our assistant producer. Leonardo Alanis is our intern. Chris Bennett is our music curator. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. Visit us online at uprisingradio.org. And send us your story ideas to mail@uprisingradio.org. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow at 8.